41. Washington, D.C. The shop had a metallic smell, like a used bookstore filled with old pennies. As the door closed behind him, puffs of dust cartwheeled through the air. Zig didn't say a word. Better to get a lay of the land. The magic shop was a time machine straight from the 1960s, cluttered with rusty spinner racks and vintage bookcases filled with magic wands, exploding pens, X-ray specs, and everything else that used to be sold in the ads in the back of old comic books. Then Zig's eye caught the stainless steel surveillance camera up on the ceiling, a round lens at the center with seven little lenses circling it. Thermal imaging. Military hardware. In a decrepit magic shop. "Anybody home?" Zig called out, approaching the L-shaped glass counter. No one answered. Next to the antique cash register was a dirty ashtray and an open can of cream soda. Someone was...
"Hope you're not here for the bathroom," a man in his late 80s called out in a southern twang.
With a big barrel chest, buzzed gray hair, and a long nose that had outgrown his face, he hobbled out from the back room, the sound of a toilet still flushing behind him.
"Because if you are, I apologize for what I just did in there."
"Sounds like my ex-wife," Zig teased, determined to keep things light.
"You look like you got something on your mind," the man said as Zig eyed a pale yellow business license underneath the glass counter.
"Registered to Joe Janisewski."
"Janisewski?" Zig asked, feigning excitement. "My whole family's Polish, though that just gives me lots of vowels in my name."
"Haven't been called that in years," the old man said,
pointing to a business card taped to the front register. "The Amazing Caesar, greatest magician in D.C., except for the liars in Congress." "I take it you're the owner?" Zig asked.
"For the past few years. Original owner is there."
He pointed at a Bozo the Clown head up on the wall, stuffed and displayed like a wild animal. Bozo had a perma-smile. It was meant to be a gag. Zig wasn't laughing.
"Clown jokes don't seem to land the way they used to. But at least it keeps the little kids out of here," the old man jested.
Though again, it didn't feel like much of a joke.
"So what kind of magic can I help you with?"
"Just looking for a few supplies. Some mouth coils, a new squeaker. Plus I'm due for a new thumb tip," Zig said, recalling the list he memorized from a magic website.
The old man nodded, taking a sip of his cream soda. He had an elderly warmth about him, but dark, doubting eyes, the color of dirt. His hands were big like manhole covers, and though his posture was no longer at its peak, no question, former military. In the field, not behind a desk. An old bruiser.
"What size for the thumb tip?" the Amazing Caesar asked.
"Usually a medium."
"Even though thumb tips are individually measured and don't come in small, medium, or large?"
Zig just stood there, feeling the stare of Bozo the Clown and that thermal camera.
"Want to start again? Maybe without all the horse manure this time?" the old magician challenged.
"I'd like to ask a few questions."
"About what?"
At this point, it made no sense to hold back. "Harry Houdini and Operation Blue Book."
"I think you have the wrong person."
"Sir, I'm not insulting you, so please don't insult me."
"I'm guessing this is a shop and drop, yes?" Zig asked. "The government had them all over the world. People came in and gave a password. If it was right, the shop would give them something they needed. Whatever the case, I know that a man named Marcus Romita came in here before he..."
"You're not listening to what I'm saying."
Stepping out from behind the main display case, Caesar lumbered toward Zig, putting a hand on his shoulder and shooing him toward the door.
"I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know who Marcus is, and if you..."
"I'm not your enemy here," Zig said, hands in the air.
Caesar kept pushing. He was stronger than he looked.
"Sir, if you'll just listen..." "I don't like liars. Even worse, I don't like people pretending to be magicians so they can case my place.
That's disingenuous bullshit, Caesar said, reaching the door and pulling it open. Listen to me. My name is Jim Zigarowski. I don't care if you're Elvis Aaron Presley, and I'm from Tennessee, where that still matters. If you don't get out of my shop, the crash. Please. The plane that crashed. I know you saw the news. The plane that went down in Alaska. Zig's voice was racing, pleading as he stood there in the threshold, Caesar about to slam the door in his face. 7 people died on that flight. The pilot was 29. An army lieutenant, Anthony Trudeau, was 25. They all died. And one of them... Zig felt that pill in his neck. The Globus. He swallowed, but it still wouldn't go away. I'm just asking for 2 minutes of your time. Please. 2 minutes. Caesar looked down his long nose, his dirt eyes unreadable. I hate watching cable news. It makes you dumber. So I guess I missed it. You have a good day, Mr. Zigarowski. With a slam, the amazing Caesar was gone, leaving Zig alone in the street, watching the puffs of his own breath. Okay, so that went crappily, Dino said through the phone as Zig headed back up the block. That's the very last time I'm buying any Saw a Girl in Half boxes from that magic shop. He knows who Marcus is. I could see it in his face. You knew that 2 hours ago. Yeah, but now we have his name. The Amazing Caesar, Zig said, reaching for his car keys and... Ziggy? You there? You okay? In his pocket, Zig felt his car keys. And something else. A small, folded-up sheet of paper. Zig pulled it out, confused. How did... Unfolding the paper, he read the handwritten message. Capital Skyline Hotel, I Street, 10 minutes. Zig looked over his shoulder, back at the shop. Show-off magicians. 42. Dover Air Force Base, Delaware. There are plenty of places to hold a private meeting at Dover. Staff offices, conference rooms, the clean break room, the medical examiner's room, the chaplain's office, or even the casket storage room. There's also the embalming room and the viscera prep room, which don't allow cameras. But when Master Guns heard that someone wanted to see him here, in this room, accessible only from the back of the building, he knew he wouldn't leave here without some bruises. Lifting a roll-top metal door, Master Guns revealed a long concrete hallway. There were a few doors along the sides, a mop closet and a contamination shower. But Master Guns's attention was focused straight ahead at the dead end, a set of double metal doors reinforced with 5 inches of steel. There was no room number out front, no door handles either. These doors opened only from the inside. Master Guns knew better than to knock. They'd be expecting him. Sure enough, as he approached, the steel door rumbled open. I'm here to see... Not out here, warned a man with a dark suit and a heart-shaped face. He scanned the hallway as he led Master Guns inside. The room was dark. There were no windows. It took a moment for Master Guns's eyes to adjust. People called it a room, but it was really a bunker, its bare walls built with steel-reinforced concrete that was at least a foot thick. Metal on the belt, the man said, pointing Master Guns to one of 2 Rapiscan metal detectors. Now they were just trying to intimidate. You're kidding, right? On the belt, said a second man, also in a dark suit. When fallen service members are carried off the plane at Dover, this is actually their first stop. One by one, each body is run through the scanner to check for unexploded ordnance, concealed IEDs, and any other booby traps that might be hidden on a body. The reinforced walls can withstand just about any blast, except for maybe the one that was coming. Let's go, heart-shaped face added, motioning to the plastic bin by the metal detector. Master Guns unloaded his homicide badge, a pen, a Leatherman combo knife and pliers, and his Beretta 9mm. He then reluctantly pulled off his dog tags and dropped them into the plastic bin. There was a high-pitched beep. A green light went off as he stepped through the scanner. Master Guns was close enough now that he saw the five-pointed star pin on heart-shaped face's lapel. Secret Service. There were plenty of private places at Dover, but none as private as this. The agent handed Master Guns a thin cell phone that looked like nothing else on the market. "Hello," Master Guns said. "Please hold for the president," a female voice announced. 43. Washington, D.C. The Capitol Skyline Hotel sat on a corner, across the street from a construction lot on one side, a homeless shelter on the other, and diagonally from a McDonald's, which was where Zig parked. For 2 minutes, Zig stared out his front windshield, fighting off the smell of French fries and scanning the hotel for anyone who might be watching. All clear, at least from here. Zig didn't want to be early. He pulled out his phone, looking again at the photos he took yesterday at Nola's office. The painted canvases. He'd forgotten about them until now, but here he was, again staring at the haunting portraits that Nola had done. He swiped left, enlarging the photos of the names on the back. Daniel Graff, Monterey, California. Sergeant Denise Madigan, Kuwait. A quick Google search told him the rest. They had one thing in common. "Huh," Zig muttered, making a mental note. He put his phone away and stepped outside. Something to deal with later. Keeping his head down as he walked across the street, Zig entered through a side door, which was marked with its own warning. Doors lock at night. Designed by an architect in the futuristic modular style of 1960s Miami Beach, the Capitol Skyline Hotel aged into one of those outdated concrete behemoths that people hated about downtown D.C., until the family of one of the Studio 54 developers threw millions into the interior, declared it retro, and suddenly, poof, it was chic. Sure enough, as Zig reached the modernist lobby with its chocolate-brown leather Barcelona chairs and hip deco wallpaper, the place felt more South Beach than Southwest D.C. "Anything I can help you with?" called a male desk clerk who was a little too handsome for his own good. "Meeting a friend," Zig said, eyeing a nearby couple, two men who could both give the desk clerk a run in the handsome contest. In a place like this, the amazing Caesar would stick out like a turd in a fishbowl. But there was no sign of him. Same in the fancy restaurant. Same when Zig checked the poolside lounge in back. "Nothing, huh?" Dino whispered through the phone as Zig returned to the lobby. "Maybe he got scared," Zig said as two sliding doors opened on his left. Outside, idling in front, was a two-tone 80-era Lincoln Continental. "Dino? What kind of car did your grandfather drive?" "Same as every pop-pop. His trusty Lincoln, why?" Zig nodded to himself, heading straight for the car. The perfect accessory for an 80-year-old magician. Yet as Zig stepped outside, the car started moving, a slow, easy roll out to the street. Through the window, Zig spotted the driver, a young woman with cat's-eye glasses and those stretch earlobe things that the military would never allow. Just another hipster who didn't realize her trend was over. "Need a cab?" one of the valets called out. "Thanks, I'm set," Zig said, watching the car disappear up the street. "Maybe our shuttle, then?" "No, I'm—" Zig turned to the valet, a lanky kid with acne scars. The valet kept staring, shooting Zig a look. It wasn't a question. "Maybe you'd really like our shuttle," the valet repeated, pointing far too long at the boxy airport shuttle bus with the bright red stripe. "Yeah, no, that's a good idea," Zig said, heading for the shuttle. As he got closer, the shuttle doors didn't open. He tapped the glass with his knuckles. Still nothing. Then he gave them a push, and the bifold doors gave way. Zig climbed the carpeted steps. The driver's seat was empty. But when he looked to his left, in the very last row there was an older man in a tan trilby hat with a pinch front. "Abracadabra, Mr. Zigarowski," the amazing Caesar said. "I should warn you, I'm only doing this because of those people who died. They deserve better." Now, would you mind shutting off your phone? Despite what you think, not all magicians love an audience.
44. Homestead, Florida, 11 years ago. This was Nola when she was 15. It was after school, nearly 5 o'clock. Ms. Sable was grading papers as Nola cursed at the charcoal pencil in her hand. According to the syllabus, charcoals wouldn't be introduced until next year in advanced art. But Nola was ready, Ms. Sable insisted, teaching Nola that when you work with charcoals, you have to grip them differently than a pencil. Hold it with your thumb and pointer finger, Ms. Sable had explained, holding her own arm up and revealing a glimpse of the tiny initials tattooed on her forearm. And keep your palm off the page. Charcoals smear. It was that precise detail that had Nola cursing and starting again, rubbing the paper with a kneaded putty eraser that lifted the charcoal off the page.
I hate this, Nola said.
Just draw the damn jug, Ms. Sable shot back, pointing Nola to the aquamarine water jug at the center of the table. For the next half hour, both were silent, both lost in their work. This had been Nola's afternoon for weeks now, sketching, drafting, practicing. Extra credit, they called it. For Nola, although she wouldn't know it for years, this time with Ms. Sable, it wasn't a relationship that was simply about art. It was a relationship about respect. Great Hera. Good for you, Sophie, Ms. Sable said to herself, flipping to a new sheet of drawing paper and admiring a pencil sketch that smiling Sophie had submitted. It was of Sophie's dog, Flynn, a drooly pug with a wide bow tie that made him look like a Republican.
That's really good, Nola said, craning her neck to admire Sophie's art.
Miss Sable looked up, eyebrows furrowed.
What did you just say?
Miss Sable asked.
Sophie's art, Nola explained,
wondering what she did wrong.
I thought it was good.
Good?
Miss Sable asked.
You don't know enough to know what's good. If you want, you can say you like it, or that you like how it makes you feel, or even say that you love it. But if you ever say that something is good again, you'll be cleaning paintbrushes for the next month. You don't know what good is. After college, after you study form, color theory, perpetual presence, and negative space, then you can tell me what good is. Or when you get a fine arts degree and study the difference between intention and execution, then you'll know what's good. But until then, I'm the teacher. I'll tell you what's good. We clear on that?
Nola nodded, though from the look on her face, she was still clearly confused.
What? Miss Sable asked.
Nola
paused, as long a pause as she'd ever done before.
What's college?
45. Washington, D.C. Today. My phone's not on. At the Conjuring Arts, you had it on. And it's on right now, the amazing Caesar said, sliding into the driver's seat, starting the shuttle, and steering the small bus out of the driveway. You get 3 lies. That's one, Mr. Zigarowski. Zig. Friends call me Zig. Caesar's eyes slid to his right. Zig was sitting in the very first seat of the shuttle, holding the pole like an umbrella. You tell me 2 more lies, Mr. Zigarowski. This conversation's over. Reaching into his breast pocket, Zig took out his phone. I'll call you back, he whispered to Dina. Yeah, no, don't worry, I'm okay. With a tap, the phone was off. You lost someone in that plane crash, huh? Caesar asked. Zig didn't answer. For what it's worth, it's the one thing I thought you weren't bullshitting about, Caesar added. When it comes to real loss, it never leaves someone's face. Zig glanced upward at the bubble-shaped escape hatch in the shuttle's roof. Bright red letters read, Emergency Exit. Hitting the gas, Caesar spent the next 2 minutes hunched in the driver's seat, his pointer and middle fingers on the steering wheel at the 5 and 7 o'clock positions. Old man out for a casual ride.
You said you felt bad those people died. What do you know about it? Sig asked. Caesar just drove. Can you at least tell me where we're going? Zig added. I like parks, Caesar said, turning the corner and pulling to the side of the road in front of a large abandoned lot with a state-of-the-art construction trailer on it. The shuttle lurched and shuddered, Caesar not yet used to the hard clench of its brakes. Plus, I like knowing who's sniffing after me. Zig looked out the side window of the bus. This part of the neighborhood was far less developed, a scattering of open lots with no restaurants or buildings nearby. If anyone was following, they'd be impossible to miss. Pretty soon, the corporate bomb will hit, and this block will be covered in Starbucks and Paneras. But no matter how much money they pour in, this town still won't be able to produce a proper slice of pizza, Caesar said. By the by, guess how much that valet kid wanted from me to borrow his shuttle? Zig was still staring out the side window. From this distance, the 60s-era hotel, lit up at night and dotted with its TV-shaped windows, looked like a tiny concrete beehive, which brought an odd sense of calm to Zig. Something safe from home, right here in a spot where he felt so uniquely off balance. I'd like to know about Operation Blue Book, Zig insisted. Do me a favor first. Watch the key, the amazing Caesar said, pulling the key from the ignition. The shuttle went dark, the only light now coming from a shattered street lamp with an exposed bulb. Still see the key? Now I want you to hold it for me, Caesar said, swiveling his seat toward Zig and handing it over. I don't have time for a magic trick. Mr. Zigarowski, if there was ever time for a magic trick, this is most definitely it. His voice was deadpan, but as he started doing his act, you could see hints of the natural performer buried underneath. Now I want you to put the key in this envelope, he added, pulling a crisp, letter-sized envelope from his jacket pocket. Humoring him, Zig took the key and slid it into the envelope. Seal it with a lick, Caesar said. Don't worry, I didn't poison it. Zig looked down at the envelope, then licked it, sealing the key inside. Now what do you suppose is the big ta-da of the trick? I honestly don't care. I don't like magic. The only reason I know why you're here, Mr. Zigarowski. Your commitment to repetition makes it nauseatingly obvious. I'm trying to illustrate a point. When it comes to magic, do you know how many tricks there are?
I don't know. Thousands.
Don't let sarcasm mask frustration. There are four. That's it. Sure, there's levitation with all the strings and wires, and there's escape stuff which relies on gimmicked cuffs and other gaff. But for the rest of them, there are only four different magic tricks. You make something appear. You make something disappear. You make two things change place. Or you change one thing into something else. Everything in magic is a variation on those four. So what's that have to do with Operation Blue Book? Swiveling back toward the steering wheel, Caesar stared out the front window, pursing his lips, like he was trying to touch his top lip to his nose. You military, Mr. Zigarowski?
Never enlisted, but I work with our troops. Mortician, Dover Air Force Base.
Mortician? No wonder you hate magic.
You were saying something about Blue Book.
Just that you were right before. My store. It's a shop and drop. People come in, and we do a little challenge and password. I say the prearranged phrase. If they reply with the right password, well, sometimes I make something appear. Sometimes I make it disappear.
And people pay you for that?
No, 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 no. He shook his head, still staring out the front window. I don't do this for profit. I do this for... He stopped. I've got one client. My dear old Uncle Sammy.
So you do work for the government?
Again he tried to touch his top lip to his nose. How old are you, Mr. Zigarowski?
Late 40s. 52.
Mm-hmm.
You got lucky with that head of hair. Lady Time picks her lovers with care.
You were saying about the government.
When I enlisted, I was 17. World War II was long done, but even then, to see how our troops were treated. Someone gave my older brother a car, a used 1938 Ford Prefect, and that got him a wife, so I gave Uncle Sammy a fake age I wanted in so bad. The Marines said no, but the Navy put me in a wetsuit and let me be a frogman long before there were SEALs. When they saw I could read, they sent me to officer's school. But in military life, you know, you turn 40. If you're lucky, you turn 50. And then, no one gets old in the military, Sig said. No, you can get old. You just get less useful, the amazing Caesar said, staring out the front windshield like he was looking at something he couldn't quite bring into focus. It's the hardest part of aging. You don't even notice it at first. But boy, does that phone stop ringing. So when a colonel called me up one day and asked me if I could take a shipment for him in the magic shop, Mr. Zigarowski, it was like being at the prom and having the prettiest girl ask you to dance and then whisper in your ear that she wants to... I think I got it. I'm not sure you do. My job at the Conjuring Arts, I take pride in my shop. I built the wooden bookshelves, built the awning out front. I built it all with my own hands. And I was happy with it. But when that colonel called up and asked for help, the shock of adrenaline, the electricity shooting through me. That's the real magic of life. That's what feeds us, that need to be needed. You say you're 52, Mr. Zigarowski? You're telling me you never got a charge from a need like that? For a moment, Zig stared out his window, focusing on the beehive-shaped hotel, his tongue tapping against his sharp incisor. Not really. Caesar made a noise, part laugh and part humph. You say you're a mortician. You should know better than anyone. Just because you're not dead doesn't mean you're alive. I appreciate the advice, but I know that's not the reason you brought me out here in the middle of... I brought you out here because people were killed, Caesar snapped, his voice showing its first hint of... not just anger, guilt. 7 people, yes. I need to make that right. I appreciate that, sir. So if we can get back to the colonel, what kind of shipments was he asking you to take? You're assuming I'm a bad person, Mr. Zigarowski. This isn't some crooked underground operation. It's a necessity of military life. In the old days, when our SEALs needed a dozen clean laptops, they went through acquisitions. Today, with WikiLeaks dumping every battle plan on the internet, if there's an above-top-secret mission in Yemen that no one can ever find out about, well, acquisitions can't be trusted. And you certainly can't head over to the Best Buy with a shipping address that says the Pentagon. So all across the country there are places like mine, shops run by nostalgic old vets who miss their old lives so much, they're happy to take delivery on whatever Uncle Sammy needs to keep quiet. And you know how we do it? The same way as those 4 magic tricks. Sleight of hand. Sleight of hand is the end result. But when it comes to selling a sleight, do you know the trick to the trick itself? Caesar paused. Ever the showman, then pumped his overgrown eyebrows and cupped his hands together. The big motion covers the small motion, like this. Shaking his still cupped hands, he did a quick 3 count, then lifted one hand away, revealing a familiar gold Seiko. Is that my watch? Sig asked. That's what you get for looking so hard at that envelope with the key, Caesar said, dangling the watch off his crooked finger and handing it back. You asked about Houdini before. He used to do the same.
He'd have you check his mouth for lockpicks and other files, but while you were doing that, no one would notice that good old Harry had 6 fingers. He'd wear a fake hollow pinky, where he'd store metal picks and a thin, bendable Geely saw that could slice through anything. Or he'd hook a lockpick on the back of your shirt while you examined him, then pull it off when you were done. He pantomimed his left hand moving high in the air. The big motion, then closed the fist of his right hand, like he had something in it, covers the small motion. So in this metaphor, the conjuring arts, these days, every country in the world, every enemy we have, has a team of computer nerds on staff. They watch the Pentagon, what we order, our supply lines. They watch the big moves. And while they're watching those big moves, they don't see the small ones being funneled through your little magic shop. Zig nodded. That part made sense. But what's that have to do with Operation Blue Book? You said you needed to make something right. Caesar cupped his hands again. 1, 2, 3. Then revealed a shiny silver dollar. He cupped his hands again. 1, 2, 3. Clink. Another silver dollar. Then, clink, another. Slowly, though, his expression changed, and 1, 2, 3. As a new silver dollar clinked against the others, his features fell, looking despondent. Caesar, if you know something, I'm a good person. A good American, Caesar insisted as, clink, he lifted his hand and another silver dollar appeared. I served our country my entire adult life, and when they needed me to do a little more by helping with these shipments, I served again. In the beginning, it wasn't much. A new delivery would show up every 6 months or so. After 9/11, of course, more shipments started coming in. During the heyday, I signed for so many laptops, printers, flip phones, and chargers, I swear to Moses, our government was single-handedly keeping the CDW computer catalog in business. But again, that's the job, right? At least I'm in the game. I'm alive. Back from the dead. The amazing Caesar feels amazing again. So amazing that I didn't even realize they were about to play me for a sucker. It started a few months ago, when I got the kind of delivery you never want to sign for. No packaging. Just a briefcase. Military issue. Bomb-proof. They told me not to look inside. Zig sat there, silent. What was I supposed to do? I'm a breathing human, and they were stupid enough to leave it with someone who's a master at picking locks. I had to take a peek. And inside? There it was. The deadliest weapon of all. Neat stacks of cash. $200,000. You never moved cash before? This is Uncle Sammy. Half the time I assumed I was moving cash. For this one, though, they said my contact would be someone named Houdini, which I thought was just their way of making fun of my store, like, ha ha, you 80-year-old fool, you're spending your retirement in a magic shop. Then they told me the code name. Operation Blue Book. 46. You're looking at me like I'm supposed to know what that means, Zig said. Even I don't know what their current operation is. But I know the history, the amazing Caesar said. You never heard the stories? Houdini and his blue book? I looked online. Said it was some sort of code book. Not just a book. It was part of Houdini's act. At the peak of his fame, his shows had 3 parts. First, there was the magic. In the palm of Caesar's hand, he squeezed the silver dollars. He opened his hand. Now they were gone. Second, he'd do his escapes. From handcuffs, straitjackets, and of course the Chinese water torture one. But during the final years of his life, the best part of every show was when he'd expose the fraud of local mediums. You mean like fortune tellers? Back then they were called spiritualists. They even had their own religion. Spiritualism, based on the idea that you could talk to the dead. Today, of course, it makes you think of palm readers and crystal balls. But in those days, this so-called religion was big business. And people believed it? It was right after World War I. Families who lost their sons in battle got preyed upon by hucksters offering seances. To Houdini, whose heart was broken by the death of his mom, Sig said, remembering what Wag said, which he'd confirmed online. Exactly. Houdini felt that pain personally from the loss of his mother. From there, he made it his mission to go after spiritualists. He saw it as the most hurtful crime of all, ripping open old wounds and taking advantage of someone's lost family member or lost child. I mean, can you imagine? Zig could. He'd been imagining it since the moment he thought it was Nola in the morgue, since the moment she returned to his life. The worst of it was last night, when she manipulated him into going to her office just to see who would follow. Zig could live with the maneuverings. Indeed, he had to respect her for a smart play like that. No, for Zig, the real pain came from what it showed him about himself. A decade since the funeral, he wasn't a novice mourner. Zig knew where his scars were. He was used to living with them on a daily basis. Plus, he worked in death, spending years using it to inoculate himself against the shattered feeling that came with the loss of Maggie. To be around so many young fallen took away the greatest weapon in death's arsenal, just being with other mourners. Zig no longer felt alone. And then, Nola appeared, this girl who saved his daughter, and in an eye blink, all that protective work was unraveled, tearing his skin off in sheets and reminding him of the one thing he'd worked so hard to overcome. The deepest wounds, the ones that pierce you to your core. They heal, but they never disappear. Can you please tell me what this has to do with the blue? I already did. It was the secret of Houdini's trick, the secret behind all his tricks. Big motion covers the small motion, right? Caesar asked. Eric Weiss, a.k.a. Harry Houdini, was the big motion, the star of the show. But while everyone was focused on him, the real work was being done by Houdini's secret service. His what? That's what he called them. They were his closest confidants, his wife, his brother, an assistant named Amadeo Vaca, Zig blurted. You know him? Zig shook his head, noticing a dim light outside. In the distance, up the block, a car came to a stop, its headlights glowing. It was parallel with the shuttle, still debating whether to turn. Vaca's name was listed as one of the passengers on board the plane that crashed in Alaska. Same with Rose Mackenberg and Clifford Eddy Jr. Both were also members of Houdini's secret service, Caesar said. So someone's using old Houdini names? That's our theory. Caesar took a long look at Zig, who was still studying the headlights outside. Even from here, there was no mistaking the siren on the roof. Police car. Mr. Zigarowski, those three names you just mentioned, they weren't the only people on the plane, were they? Please help me make this right. Was someone you care about on there too? It's a long story. I'm 87. I've got time. I'm not sure we do, though, Zig said, motioning to the police car in the distance. I see him. Rental cops. We hire them for the neighborhood. They've passed us twice now, Caesar said as the car started moving, disappearing to their left. Anywho, you were saying? No, you were saying. About Houdini's secret service. Right. Before Harry got to a town, Vaca, Mackenberg, Eddie, and the others, they would come a few days early and do the recon work, figuring out everything from what brand of handcuffs the local police used, so Houdini would have a key when he challenged them to lock him up, to what kind of locks were on the jail cells. But their number one mission was to help Houdini prepare for the big finale of the act, exposing mediums and fake fortune tellers. It was Houdini at his sneakiest. Back then, whenever a medium would travel to a new town, they'd establish themselves by approaching someone in a prominent family and saying, "I have a message for you from your dead brother," or dead mother, or whoever it was. Then they'd ID the person by name, like, "Someone named Maggie is in great pain." "What did you just say?" "Back at my shop, you gave me your name, Mr. Zigarowski. You think I didn't do a quick Google search? I found the obituary. I'm sorry you lost your daughter." "That's not your proving my point. Today the internet makes it easy. Back then, though, it would blow people's minds. How'd this stranger know all those details about me?" But no one realized that the mediums themselves had their own underground network. They called it the Blue Book. In every town, they'd write down all the details of everyone who lived there. Mr. Montgomery recently buried his wife Abigail after she fell from a horse. Mrs. Addison is blind in one eye and lost a sister named Gertie. That's what it said online, that it was like a hobo code. With more details and info. Think of it as Google 0.01. They'd hide the Blue Book in a known spot, somewhere by the train station, and when different mediums would come to town, they'd study the book and immediately be ready to show off their amazing powers. In Houdini's act, he'd grab the Blue Book first, call the local mediums on stage, and show everyone what frauds they were. So when you opened that briefcase full of cash and saw the paperwork for Operation Blue Book, whoever's pulling the strings here, they're obviously Houdini superfans. They're using his old tricks, the names of his old agents. But what set me off wasn't the bomb-proof suitcase or even the cash inside it. It was the pickup man who came for it. The one they called Houdini. Like I said, I've been doing this since Nixon was cursing in the White House. Every 6 months or so, Uncle Sammy sends someone to my shop. We make small talk. They mention the code name. I give them a package. No one's perfect, but most people are generally nice. This guy Houdini, though. You ever give your car keys to a valet and start worrying about your house keys being on that key ring, too? Zig nodded, noticing that through the front windshield, a few blocks away, there was another set of headlights. A new car was slowly coming toward them. Nothing to worry about. At least, not yet. For most of my pickups, they send me Marines or SEALs. They're kids, messengers. But they're solid, like hammers, Caesar explained. This so-called Houdini, he was older, in his 40s at least. And when you spot a colonel suddenly doing a corporal's job, you know something's not right. That's why I popped the locks on his suitcase. Then after his first pickup, my phone rings again, and rings even more. Deliveries start coming more frequently. Every other month, then once a month, then every 2 weeks. And the suitcase? It's getting heavier. Whoever Houdini is, he's not just moving a few shekels. He's moving cash. More and more with each visit. All of it peaking 4 days ago when my phone rings and there he is, telling me that something big is coming, that I need to keep an eye out. And guess where that shipment was from? Alaska. Every time he came in, I swear, I had that bad feeling. But I'm a good American, Mr. Zigarowski. My orders were clear. Accept the cash and hand it over. Yet when I saw the news of that plane, I swear,
I had that same bad feeling, praying it was just coincidence. But for you to show up now, Sacred Mary, if I caused those people's deaths, Caesar, you couldn't have. I knew. Deep in my belly, I could feel it. Every time he came in, I knew something was off. And then for him to start calling me personally, checking to see exactly when his suitcase would arrive. No one does that. It was like he had a personal stake in it. Hold on. Back up. He called you personally? So you know how to reach him? Yeah, sure. For emergencies only. Why? Zig thought about that. Then right there, Zig had a brand new idea. 47. Dover Air Force Base, Delaware.
What can I do for you, Mr. President?
Let me first say I appreciate what you do there in Dover.
We all do, Francis, President Wallace said, using Master Guns's first name. Even with admirals, most presidents do away with titles and keep things informal.
Thank you, sir.
To that end, I know you're busy. I'll keep this quick. We were wondering. He stopped himself, taking a moment. The concrete bunker was silent.
I was wondering about that plane that went down in Alaska.
He stopped again.
I'd like to know how the investigation is going.
Master Guns glanced at the two Secret Service agents, both of whom were now pretending to look down at the metal detector. It wasn't uncommon for White House staff to contact Dover. This week they were calling at all hours. But in 19 years, this was the first and only time a president had called directly.
We're just getting started, sir, Master Guns said. I will say, I think we're proceeding along nicely.
I'm glad to hear that, Francis, because as I understand it, you're our chief homicide investigator there, correct?
Master Guns paused, sensing a trap. He'd never met President Wallace, but he knew all politicians were natural-born liars, especially the world's top politician.
I'm not sure what you're getting at, sir.
What I'm getting at is that as chief investigator, you're the one who goes out in the field.
Last month, when that helicopter with four of our soldiers went down in the Philippines, you immediately flew to the Philippines. When that corporal went on a shooting spree at our base in Turkey, you flew to Turkey the next day. You interviewed everyone, examined it up close, and made a determination. But here we are with a plane down in Alaska, an entire crime scene out in the snow.
And you're still sitting there at Dover 4 days later.
His dog tags clinked around his neck as he put them back on. Master Guns chose his next words carefully.
Sir, if you're accusing me of something,
Francis, do you know what's on my schedule after I hang up with you?
Pardon me, sir?
It's late in the day. At this hour, I usually get my final briefing from my national security team. After that, I return phone calls, like the one I have to make to Senator Castronovo, who's been busting my chops on every damn cable show over the rehaul I proposed for the post office system. But tonight, do you know what I'll be doing instead?
Writing a eulogy.
I know you and Mr. Rookstuhl were close, Master Guns said, referring to the Librarian of Congress.
I'm sorry you have to.
Don't be sorry. This is my honor. Nelson was in my wedding party. On the night my son was born, he brought a wiffle ball bat to the hospital. If he were just a friend, I'd have our top speechwriter write his eulogy. She'd do a beautiful job, too. But for Nelson.
The president made a noise, a grunt that sounded like, nuh-uh.
When I stand there at his funeral on Friday, when I look down at Nelson's son and two daughters, at his 10-year-old grandson, this is a story only I can tell.
So once again, Francis, tell me why you're sitting on your thumbs in Delaware rather than sitting on a plane heading to Alaska.
Because it's my job, sir.
No, your job is to find out why that plane went down.
No, Master Guns said as both Secret Service agents turned at his tone. Master Guns stared back, still gripping the phone. With all due respect, sir, my job is to investigate. And as we both well know, a few hours after that plane crashed in Alaska, two men in suits were waiting in my office, demanding Sergeant Brown's body. Do you know what that did to the investigator in me? It told me to start investigating anyone who's interested in that body, or, more importantly, this case. To my surprise, sir, that person is now you. The phone went silent. Not for long, though. The president's voice stayed calm and steady. Like yesterday out on the runway, no matter how hard the wind blew, Wallace didn't let a hair on his head get out of place. I'm glad to hear that, Francis, because the very last thing I want is for you to go easy on this. I can assure you, I never go easy, Mr. President. Honesty is my true north. Funny you should mention that, Wallace said, and right then, Master Guns realized the trap wasn't coming. It had already been sprung. Earlier today, Francis, the service took a look at Dover's security records. And you know what they found? According to the card swipe systems in your building, an ID with your name on it was used to access a room called Personal Effects. But when they cross-checked their other reports, they realized that a mortician named Jim Zagorowski was attacked in that exact room at that exact time. Master Guns stood at full attention, replaying how he let Zig use his ID to take a quick look in the room. I would never hurt Zig. That's the right answer, Francis. And I assume that if we look at all the photos that were taken out on the runway, we'll find one with you on the back of the plane at the same time you were supposedly in that personal effects room. But the fact remains that even if you weren't the one who personally attacked Mr. Zagorowski, the person who did it was someone who knew that he would be there at that time. And as far as my people can tell, you're one of the few who fit that bill. In fact, Francis, you're the only one who fits that bill. Zig is my friend, and Nelson Rookstuhl is my friend. The most powerful man in the world said, "Do your job, Francis, because I promise you, we'll be doing ours." Before Master Guns could say a word, there was a click. The President of the United States was gone. The agent with the heart-shaped face pointed to the door. "This is the easiest way. I know how to get out," Master Guns said, plowing toward the exit. In the hallway, he waited for the steel door to slam behind him. Then he pulled out his phone, the one his wife didn't know about. Master Guns sent a quick text. "We need to talk."
48. Washington, D.C. Nola was cold. She was hungry, too, with nothing but a scattering of granola bar wrappers tossed across the passenger seat. Granola bars were never a proper meal, no matter how many you ate. She'd been sitting in the car for hours now, her notepad propped against the steering wheel as she drew another sketch, in green pencil, of the old storefront diagonally down the street. She liked using green in winter. Made everything seem serene. According to phone records, this was the one landline Marcus called from his cell, squeezed between a check cashing place and a liquor store. Powell Rock, Inc. It was an insurance agency. Prudential. The front glass window had the old 80s logo that built the Rock of Gibraltar out of a few slanted lines, with these words underneath. "Get a piece of the rock with Benjamin R. Powell." Prudential updated the logo years ago. The same wasn't true of the storefront. With its peeling sign and tattered blue-striped awning, it was decades past its golden days. As Nola continued to draw, new details popped out. The pattern of zigzagging cracks in the storefront's wood paneling, rotting underneath. The rust streaks below the gutters. Definitely a leak there. And the subtle sag of the roofline that made the front sign look higher on the right than on the left. Foundation problems for sure. Yet of all the details in Nola's sketches, the most noticeable was what wasn't there. People. For hours now, no one went in the place, no one came out. Not a big deal for most insurance agencies. Walk-ins had to be rare. But here, there were no customers, no employees, no deliveries, nothing. Even after lunch, when the rest of the street swelled with locals, Powell Insurance was lifeless. Only one way to find out what's going on. Readjusting the mesh baseball cap that she'd bought at a gas station, Nola picked up her new disposable phone and started to dial. But as she entered the number, across the street in front of the coffee shop, a quick movement caught her eye. A fluffy white dog, a Bichon, no, a Havanese, was being yanked on his leash, back toward his owner, a heavy man with a beard. Middle-aged, expensive shoes, expensive gloves, likes to be noticed. He was talking, leaning in toward a younger woman. Late 30s, no lipstick, no wedding ring. Still deciding if she's buying his bullshit. The dog let out a high-pitched whine, trying to get to a nearby tree in front of the coffee shop. The dog had to pee. The man yanked the pup back, then yanked him again, still focused on the woman. The dog was begging now, whining and pleading, like he was in pain. Yank! Nola was tempted to get out, tempted to have a few words about the way this man was treating his dog. But now wasn't the time. Stay focused, she thought, entering the final digits of the phone number. But just as she did, the man gave another yank, a hard one that, as the dog was in mid-jump, sent the furry animal crashing on its back, scrambling to right itself. Shutting her phone and tossing her sketchpad aside, Nola kicked open the car door. Damn it, she cursed herself, knowing she was being stupid. But as the dog let out a yelp, screw it. She headed straight toward the man. The dog was rattled now and skittish, looking up as Nola got closer. She walked up to the man. His lower teeth slanted sideways like half-fallen towers of Pisa. No braces when he was young. To afford those shoes and gloves, he worked for it. You got something to say? The man challenged, turning toward Nola, expecting her to back up. She stayed where she was. Your dog's trying to tell you something. You fucking kidding me?
Mason, not here, the woman warned.
This wasn't the first time he lost his temper. Nola turned to Mason, so close that her elbow was now touching the woman he was talking to, edging her out of the way. I have a thing about animals, Nola said. She glanced at him and let him take a good long look at her black eyes with flecks of gold. Let him see the depth of the hole he was about to step into. In her pocket, she was still holding the green pencil she'd been sketching with. She eyed 14 places to impale him, 6 of them deadly. This close to the man, she saw the hair plug divots along his forehead, the edge of the contact lenses in his slowly widening eyes, and even the one stray thread sticking up at the collar of his designer wool overcoat. Over his shoulder, people in the coffee shop were starting to stare, including a Native American woman with a long black ponytail, dressed casually, sipping her latte and looking up from her newspaper. The white dog continued to whimper. Go potty, Crackerjack. That's it, go potty, the man said, letting the dog drag him toward the tree where Crackerjack quickly relieved himself. Happy now? The man asked. Nola ignored him, locking eyes with the man's girlfriend. You can tell a lot about a person by how they treat their dog. Leaving them behind, Nola headed back to her car as she pulled out her phone and quickly redialed the number for Powell Insurance. Time to get some answers.
49. The amazing Caesar had a throbbing pain in his hip. The doctors blamed it on the way he carried his weight, always leaning to one side as osteoporosis compressed his spine. They told him he should take it easy, whatever that meant. But as Caesar began dialing the phone number from the back of his magic shop, he was still leaning on his left side. At a certain age, you can't change who you are. Hello? You there? Caesar asked into the phone as someone picked up. It was quiet on the other end, and Caesar could feel an unnerving silence seeping through the large room, a long rectangular space almost as big as the public part of the shop, though far less cluttered. There was an old oak desk, tall and short mismatched file cabinets, but really most of the room was empty, facing the huge metal roll-up door that led to the alley. This wasn't an office. It was a shipping and receiving area. "Everything okay?" asked the man known as Houdini. He sounded annoyed, but there was something else in his voice. Concern, and a real sense of charm, like he was worried about Caesar. "Something came in today," Caesar offered. "A package. For you." Houdini went silent. No one mentioned any shipments. "I'm just relaying what's here. And from the smell that's leaking from it, I think you may have a problem." "The smell?" "It actually smells bad," Caesar insisted. Houdini knew what that meant. Counterfeit money had its own odor from the printing. It made no sense. The government wouldn't use phony money, which meant this was from someone else. So now Houdini was curious. "Any idea who sent it?" Houdini asked. "I just signed for deliveries. If you want, I can send it back." "No, it's fine. It's good. If you want, I'll be right over," Houdini said. "You'll stay late, yes? Sign outside says closed, but I'm in back." That's all Houdini needed to hear. With a click, he was gone. Caesar hung up the phone and sat back in his chair, leaning to the left. 7 people were dead. This was his chance to make it right. "He's on his way?" Zig asked behind Caesar.
"You put meat in the trap, you'll get the lion," Caesar said. "Now you just have to figure out what to do with him."
50. Homestead, Florida, 10 years ago. This was Nola when she was 16.
"Get over here,"
Royal growled, grabbing Nola hard by the arm. Breakfast was finished, and she was in the kitchen doing dishes. The water was running, Nola reaching back to shut the faucet even as Royal tugged her to the door. If it kept running, she'd pay for that, too.
"What did I do?"
Nola asked, replaying the last few hours. Saturday laundry had already started. Yesterday's shopping was done. She'd put all his change by his wallet except for the few quarters she always stole. Was this about the quarters?
"Move your ass,"
he insisted, kicking open the screen door and pulling her into the backyard. She tripped over one of their new but crooked patio stones as they headed for the overturned kiddie pool. Nola knew what the pool covered. The hole underneath, a new one that Nola had been digging since they moved to this new house.
"You see this?"
Royal asked. She was off balance, her hands still wet with dishwashing soap, tiny sudsy bubbles popping along her fingertips. Next to the kiddie pool, she eyed the nearby shovel with the pointy spade.
"Dummy, look!"
He was pointing straight up at the sky. It was morning, but the moon was floating there, a faint half-circle visible in the pale blue sky. Like a chalk drawing, Nola thought.
"Pick one,"
Royal said.
"The what?"
"Pick one. The sun or the moon?"
He pointed up at both, though the sun was mostly out of sight.
"Pick."
Nola paused, thinking it was a trick. Royal was too calm, the bounce in his voice too happy.
"Come on, Nola, pick. Sun or moon?"
"I don't get it."
He rolled his eyes, now annoyed.
"Listen, I know I'm not a good dad, okay? I don't buy you stuff. With the business," he said, referring to the passport and other forgeries he was now doing on an even bigger scale, "I need to put our cash into printers and laminators rather than wasting it on useless toys or presents. It lets us have a nice life. This new house," he explained. "But someone told me this story. I think it's from a movie or a book. This dad tells his kids to pick a star in the sky. That way, when all the wealthy kids' presents are gone, his kids will always have that star, you know? I just figured, I don't know, If stars are good, the sun or the moon's better. I mean, today's your birthday, right?
Nola nodded. He never remembered her birthday. Not for years. And he rarely bought her anything, not when he could make more cash upgrading his ever-expanding document business, which had recently caught the attention of Royal's new boss, Mr. Quentin Wesley. From the bus ads she'd seen around town, "Got a mess? Call Wes." Wesley was a local immigration lawyer. He was also a crook, Nola decided, considering how many fake social security cards, phone bills, and driver's licenses complete with magnetic strips Royal was churning out in their back bedroom for seemingly hundreds of Wesley's undocumented clients. Wesley told Royal from the start, "Your work is truly masterful." According to the bus benches, Wesley also did a little criminal law, which brought an influx of ex-cons. Royal didn't mind convicts. Everyone deserved a fresh start. But when Wesley asked Royal to build a top-shelf wallet for a 50-year-old pedophile who was tired of everyone knowing his business, Royal refused. "Now you're suddenly a snob? Peds pay top dollar," Wesley had told him. "Don't care," Royal had shot back. "Every man has a line. Even Royal wouldn't do that."
"So there's my gift," Royal told Nola. "Your choice, the sun or the moon. Just fucking pick one, all right?"
Nola looked up toward the sky. Her voice was soft.
"The moon."
"Yeah,"
Royal said, craning his neck and looking up with her.
"Me too."
For a minute, the two of them stood there in the backyard, both of them staring up at Nola's new and only birthday present. Finally, Royal headed toward the house, glancing back at Nola over his shoulder.
"I'm not a total asshole, you know."
51. Washington, D.C. Today. The curtain wasn't happy with her coffee. It was supposed to be an artisanal Indonesian blend, a mix of toffee, citrus, and tangy herbs. But the bitter taste told her the beans were too finely ground. Typical. You need them coarser to get the full flavor, which made her think of that luscious cold brew she had in Kyoto, Japan, on the night she tracked down and opened the wrists of that German snitch who always smelled like cough drops.
"You still see her?"
a voice asked through her phone.
"You have to ask?"
the curtain shot back, glancing outside where Nola had just gotten out of her car.
"You're lucky you found her."
It wasn't luck. Once the curtain realized Nola had grabbed Marcus's phone, it was only a matter of time until Nola went through the records and tracked the landline for Powell's insurance. No different than what the curtain would have done herself.
"You sure she hasn't seen you?"
"Stop talking," the curtain was about to say. But to her surprise, Nola was now storming straight toward the coffee shop. The curtain slid her hand in her pocket, readying her blade. That is, until Nola stopped short, approaching a fat man outside who seemed to be strangling his hyperactive dog.
"What's she doing now?"
the voice asked in the curtain's ear. "Picking a fight."
"What? With who?"
"Not important. I'll call you back," she said, hanging up. Cradling her coffee cup but never drinking from it, the curtain turned her attention outside, watching through the plate glass as Nola stepped into the fat man's personal space.
Rash,
the curtain thought, calling attention to herself. Plus, not taking the time to assess who this guy might be. Nola was fighting angry now. Fighting dumb. And for what? At the end of the leash, a little white pup was whimpering, fighting to relieve itself.
A dog? Really?
The curtain made a mental note. She'd been told Nola was disciplined, unemotional. That's what made her so dangerous. But here it was, proof that she could be stirred up just like every other slob in the world. It was a detail the curtain wouldn't soon forget. Outside, as Nola argued with the man, she suddenly glanced up. For a peek a second, she and the curtain made eye contact, 20 feet apart, separated only by the front window of the coffee shop. Nola quickly turned back to the fat man, glowering at him, until he finally realized this wasn't the kind of fight he'd be walking away from. The curtain made a mental note of that, too. Everyone thought Nola Brown was a wild card, but if you watched anyone long enough, even the wildest of cards gets played with its own predictability.
How's the coffee?
A young barista called out. He was cute. Trendy but edgy beard. Someone the curtain would hit on if it were another day.
Perfect, the curtain said, taking a fake sip.
Outside, Nola headed back to the car. Her back turned.
52.
You look like death, the man known as Houdini called out. It's called old age, the amazing Caesar said as the roll-top back door rose upward, revealing his guest, a 40-something man with thinning black hair who was chewing gum so aggressively you'd think it was an Olympic event. What's your excuse? You're funny for someone from the Great Depression, Houdini shot back, stepping inside, hiding his gum in his cheek and flashing his toothy grin. It was a natural smile, one he used to his advantage to offset the intensity of his pointy fox face and skeptical brown eyes. Really, though, you don't look so good.
Yeah, well, see how you're looking when every time you sneeze you piss a little puddle in your pants, Caesar said, hitting a button and lowering the door.
Houdini forced a fake laugh as he shook hands with the old man. He didn't mind the chit-chat with Caesar. To be over 80 years old and still in the game, still feeling your blood flowing? Isn't that what everyone wants? Yet as the door rolled down, Houdini was again chewing, checking over his shoulder, making sure no one was following. He didn't mind talking with Caesar, but that didn't mean he trusted him.
So I hear you've got a new rabbit in your hat, Houdini said, motioning with his chin at the soft leather briefcase on the nearby desk.
Came in a few hours ago. Same as always, the old magician said, meaning it was addressed to Caesar, but with an H as his middle initial, for Houdini. Chewing his gum even harder, Houdini stared at the case. Most of his deliveries came in a bomb-proof attaché. This was cheap, faux leather, like something from an office depot. No return address. Caesar shook his head. Chew. You try the lock? Houdini asked, eyeing the small padlock on the main zipper. I'm just a messenger. Chew. Houdini could smell the briefcase from here, or at least what was in it. That sweet and sulfury stench, printer's ink, which meant counterfeit money, which meant someone new was at the table, or even worse, that someone had found out what Houdini and his partner were really up to. Either way, whoever that someone was, they were trying to get Houdini's attention. And right now, it was most definitely working.
You okay? Caesar asked, adding a final verbal shove.
The people who died on that plane deserved his very best.
Absolutely.
Houdini grabbed the briefcase. It felt light. There wasn't much in it. Chew.
By the way, last time, that magic trick you gave me for my nephew? The teleporting key, with the metal key that comes free from the key ring. He like it?
It was too hard for him. He's 14 and lazy. Maybe you got something simpler, like that plastic box where you put the quarter in, then turn it around and the quarter disappears?
Caesar rolled his eyes. Magic money, he said, leaving the back room and heading into the main part of the store.
It comes in a starter set, he explained as he reached a bookshelf and grabbed a box labeled Ages 5 and Up.
That's the one. I know it's easy, but he's a stupid kid. He'll love it, Houdini said, standing just behind Caesar.
You mind opening it up?
As the old magician pulled the toy from the box, he was thinking so much about the Alaska victims, he didn't even feel the gun that was now pressed to the back of his head.
Pfft. A spray of blood hit the bookshelf. Caesar swayed a moment, then crumpled, his legs first, then his upper body, plummeting to the wood floor like all his bones suddenly disappeared at once.
Thump.
The amazing Caesar took his final bow, his body convulsing as a small red puddle widened below him.
I humbly apologize to your family,
Wherever they may be, Houdini whispered. He meant it. He liked the old man, and certainly appreciated all the help he'd been over these past months. But there was a reason they called him Houdini. The man who made all problems disappear. Caesar's body continued to jerk. Houdini kept his head down, away from the video cameras, then stepped over the body and leaned down, grabbing the plastic magic trick for his nephew. Then he figured, what the heck, and snatched the entire starter set, stuffing the small box in his coat pocket. It was nearly Christmas, for Christ's sakes. Within a minute, briefcase in hand, Houdini was out the back door, weaving through the alleys behind the magic shop. His first stop, same as always. A few blocks away, Houdini turned the corner and checked over his shoulder. No one there. On his left and right, he scanned every parked car. All looked empty. There were plenty of people scattered across the sidewalk, most of them headed to or from the brand new Safeway supermarket on the next block. This block, though, was a relic of the past, which is why Houdini picked it. Across the street was a rundown storefront with a sagging striped awning. The front glass was covered in a giant peeling Prudential Insurance sticker that had these words in a smiley face curve below the logo: "Get a piece of the rock with Benjamin R. Powell." Crossing the street and approaching the thick glass door, Houdini smelled the stale cigarettes inside. For the money they were paying, couldn't they clean up the place a bit? Glancing over his shoulder one last time, he again scanned all the parked cars and every nearby storefront window. Convinced he was alone, Houdini opened the front door. It closed silently behind him.